Jeffrey, and this is the Passionate About OSS podcast. The purpose of the podcast is to shine a light on the brilliant minds of the OSS and telco industry, to describe their background, knowledge, tips, and some of the techniques they've developed over the years. In today's episode, we'll look at modern OSS BSS transformation techniques that really start with the customer. Our guest today has a track record of managing large-scale IT transformation programs in Tier 1 carrier environments in Australia and the UK. He's been in telco for over 15 years, including nearly 9 with NBN, Australia's wholesale network provider. And more recently, he's been guiding a significant transformation project at Vocus. He recently made a fantastic presentation at a TM Forum event in Sydney that relates to his work at Vocus. And that was so impressive that we published a blog article about it. We'll dive deeper into that transformation today, and that's just one of the reasons why I'm really excited to have our guest on today's episode. So welcome today to Martin Pittard.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Really appreciate it.
Great to have you on. So Martin and I first met around 4 to 5 years ago when he was program manager of network assurance at NBN. And I was consulting on the P&I solution that his team maintained. That must have been fun, being accountable for a bunch of business-critical applications and infrastructure. No pressure, right? No after-hours change management or anything like that, Martin?
Oh, look, the benefits of being the program manager is delegation, isn't it, Ryan? So I left those late nights to others. But look, I guess there's many challenges when you work on, national-scale infrastructure like the NBN. And you've touched on the life cycle for technology capabilities, but of course there's also security, customer experience, building capabilities that really support innovation, and that challenger mindset are all things that I think are come to play when we're working on programs like that network assurance at NBN.
And we'll definitely get into a little bit more about that later on, but really that was far from your first OSS BSS project. So maybe first we'll dive back a little bit deeper into the recesses of time and your career. As I understand it, you started out at Rockwell after finishing a Bachelor of Eng at uni. Now, you have to excuse my ignorance, but I kind of equate Rockwell as being an IAC or industrial automation and control type company used for factories and other industrial complexes. Is that the kind of work you were doing there?
actually, far from it. You know, Rockwell's a very large company, certainly back in those days, and I actually worked for Rockwell Systems Australia, and that was under the Aerospace Defence Division of Rockwell International. When people think of Rockwell, they're probably best known for the American B-1 Lancer bomber. I think they looked after the Space Shuttle Orbiter. And back in my time as well, they were responsible for the GPS satellites. But look, in those days at Rockwell, I was working on the Collins-class submarine, which I know your listeners would know all about that, but Rockwell was supplying various sort of elements, particularly associated with the combat system back then. So it was a great landing spot and a great organisation to start off in.
That sounds fantastic. I hadn't realised it was relating to the Collins-class subs, but I won't dive into those questions because you'd have to shoot myself and all of the audience listening.
Just on that, it was an awfully complicated combat system, and it turned out that we bit off probably more than we could chew as an organisation back then, and that combat system ended up being replaced by an American system. So not necessarily something that I underscore in my CV, but there you go.
No. And interestingly, it's an area of fascination for me, just how to relate those combat systems with command and control as it translates to, say, a NOC in a telco environment or a security operations center. Did you see any real parallels? The in theory being super mission critical, life critical, the combat systems to how we visualize and present data in a NOC or our command and control OSS BSS.
Yeah, look, I think there are some parallels back in those days. I mean, goodness, the sort of submarine, its detailed design started off, I want to say, around about 1986, would you believe? And I joined the organisation back in 91. So it was truly a full systems engineering mindset focuses on what they call HMI or the human machine interface was important because, of course, if you're in a stressful situation, the ability to present information clearly, concisely, you know, that so-called actionable information, super important. But also there was obviously a large-scale design around redundancy, quadruple redundancy for, a lot of the systems. But with that redundancy comes a lot of challenges around keeping information synchronized, et cetera, across all of those nodes. And, you know, when I think back to it, the thing that ultimately undid it, it had a mean time between failure of around about an hour, hour and a half, and it took about 12 hours to reboot. So I think, you know, it was not a good situation. But having said all of that, it really did ground me in some useful fundamentals that I took forward.
Still apply today. And so are you able to describe just at a high level what some of those foundations that you developed from there?
Yeah. Well, I think I look at it from the point of view that if we discuss the combat system, it's obviously a very large sort of complex undertaking, and the groundings were really those around the sort of systems engineering. And that had all that sort of elements of, you know, taking lofty objectives and, you know, hard deadlines, copious amounts of political public scrutiny that I guess rightly comes with projects that spend that sort of large amount of public money. But these projects require collaboration and coordination across multiple partners and suppliers. You've got to deliver against, you know, well-defined capabilities and interfaces, and all of this should sound familiar. That sort of approach, that systematic thinking approach, I think is important. But also, I guess as a young engineer, I got to work with some very talented and seasoned veterans. And when I look back over my career, I sort of think that the experience that I had back then, although it's appropriate for the scale and complexity of that sort of project, it's that traditional waterfall, you know, highly constrained, lots of gates and this sort of stuff. So understanding where to apply that rigor and where not to really helped me balance this sort of speed versus that rigor, if you will, to apply various methodologies when you take into consideration team size, dynamics, business criticality, et cetera. So certainly later on, when I was thinking about methodologies, I'm able to pick and choose and sort of say, well, you know, this sort of approach, getting an element of that end-to-end architecture bedded down so that if you're putting an agile overlay over the top of it, you've got, you know, you're making decisions with a strategic intent in mind, I think were some good lessons that I took out of that period of my career.
I love it. And I love the parallel universes, how you can still bring parallels back into the telco world and having that grounding outside the world of telco. And So on from Rockwell, you then moved on to Fujitsu, which is a name perhaps more synonymous with telco, in my mind at least. That was back in the heady days when Fujitsu was providing a lot of SDH digital backbone to carriers around the world. My first real job was a three-month contract upgrading Fujitsu equipment in many of the remote parts of Australia. So were you also working on the SDH gear and the FlexR Plus NMS that was quite revolutionary for Fujitsu at the time?
Yeah. No, that's spot on. That was back in the mid-90s. And, you know, the Australian arm of Fujitsu was very much focused on the local development of an SDH-based DSLAM, what we call the FSX 2000. And that was an important part of the build-out of Optus's initial network that I was working on. I'm sort of mindful there's plenty of acronyms there, but essentially, you know, the DSLAMs are the network equipment that sits in that local exchange and provides for that sort of data connectivity to the home. It reuses the copper pair. I'm sure many of your listeners know about ADSL, and I guess the ADSL was the first generation of technology after dial-up that provided for that sort of adaptive but faster internet speeds. It's really interesting because if you think about it, that technology is relevant even today, 25 years later, because it's still used in the NBN that underpins both the fibre to the node and fibre to the curb, you know, access technologies. But I joined Fujitsu at that time as a hardware engineer working on that SDH backhaul. And that was pretty interesting, you know, it involved a combination of circuit card design, logic design. And back then we used a technology called field programmable gate arrays, which is a kind of a programmable chip, I guess. And that dramatically allowed us to increase the density of the sort of logic that would fit on a card. But, you know, unlike software design, when you can rapidly cycle between that sort of concept, build, test, if you get it wrong, well, it's, you know, you can rework it pretty easily. There's really nowhere to hide if you muck it up with the hardware. You've got to really have that right first-time mindset. You don't want to be knocking on your boss's door saying, sorry, I've got to redesign the card and the cost and the delay that comes on from that. So back in those days, interestingly, the simulation tools, the hardware levels and logic level simulation tools played a big role in getting it right first time.
Fantastic. And in fact, it was probably that FPGA upgrade that got me that first job out in the field and going around upgrading those chips and those cards around the network, which was great fun. But I also made a huge blunder on that where I stuffed up a card swap out and it took part of the Optus mobile network down for about 20 minutes and probably cost them a few million bucks. So one of the biggest blunders of my career today.
We've all got our skeletons in the closet.
Indeed, indeed. My kind of excuse was that it was at the end of a 108-hour week too. So, my mind probably wasn't as functional as it might have been at the start of that week. Also, whilst being an NMS really, was FlexR Plus really your first foray into that parallel universe of OSS?
Yes, I think that's true. It's certainly the case that FlexR Plus was the network management system that was used to manage this DSLAM, the FSX 2000. And if I sort of remember correctly, back in those days, the NMS provided, I guess at best, an ability to manage a range of equipments, but across only a single vendor. There was very little integration back up into the OSS at the time. And back then, MTOSI, now don't ask me what the acronym was, I can't remember, but MTOSI was defining the northbound interface back up from those NMSs back up into the OSS. But there was very little adoption around that, and I guess only partial adoption of the underlying inventory models, which in those days was driven out of Etsy. Mm. So all of that meant that there were very little integrations. The integrations that did exist were really cumbersome, and we were really hamstrung, I think, as an industry because there was a lack of vendor interoperability. Basically, the NMS was locked down, and the vendor said, no, you can only use it to manage our equipment. As you can understand, you can't use that NMS to manage others. I think we live in a very different world today.
Yeah. So it would have been fully swivel chair integration then?
Very much so. Whilst the MTOSI provided a northbound interface, the real challenge, when I reflect on it, was getting those inventory models right. And they were very complicated inventory models too, but largely you had to implement them bespoke and then, align them across your various bits of vendor network equipment. That's a non-trivial task.
Mm-hmm. And then Fujitsu also took you over to the UK for a couple of years to help implement the structural separation of BT, didn't it?
Yeah, they did. That was back in 2006. It was an amazing opportunity. Yeah, at that time, Fujitsu was building out BT's next generation network alongside Huawei under a program they called the 21CN or 21 Century Network. And at that time, BT was very much the dominant market operator, and it had a significant advantage through their vertical integration. And Ofcom, who's the UK's regulator, at that time undertook a competition review, and they basically concluded that BT needed to separate its wholesale and retail businesses from the underlying network infrastructure. Now, that's, again, non-trivial. The separation basically involved not only organisations, so they'd literally had to separate their offices from the various business units. They had to separate their governance, etc. But importantly, it also entailed the separation of its massive OSS and BSS estate. And Ryan, if I recall correctly, there were some 3,000 applications that were initially identified as being potentially impacted. And it also involved the stand up of a new network business, and that was OpenReach. And the OpenReach effectively was set up to provide a set of wholesale services and common access to its physical infrastructure on standard terms to any carrier. Now, for those paying attention, you'd notice this is exactly the model we followed here in Australia with standing up the NBN.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get to that really shortly too, and the structural separation here in Australia and the use of a lot of the learnings from OpenReach. Also, we We almost crossed paths there at Fujitsu. We almost crossed paths at Alcatel-Lucent too, where you were a senior solution architect shortly after I departed. What was your role there? Was it on the Telstra transformation project as well?
Yeah, it was. So I joined Alcatel-Lucent, goodness, I think it was around about 2009 when I returned from the UK. And yeah, I was part of the Telstra transformation program. That was a huge program. There's no doubt it was BSS, OSS and network. But I guess I was more focused on the OSS and network aspects under what Telstra called the Titan program. And, you know, I looked after a range of solutions covering mostly the access and edge of Telstra's network and also part of their mobile network. But for me, the most interesting element of that was nail-biting, I guess, was looking after the migration of Telstra's entire enterprise and government services from their legacy ATM network across to their next IP network. And I've got to tell you, that was 18 months of war rooms and early morning calls. And I can tell you, I'm probably still carrying some of those battle scars.
And did you develop a combat system for there and bring the Rockwell one across?
No, not at all. It was developing a set of, you know, underlying equivalent capabilities on the next IP network and a set of tools to do the migration. But then that 18 months was effectively the execution. And invariably, you know, things didn't always go to plan. So those early morning calls were about triage and mop-up, effectively, right?
I like the use of the word execution too. How many people were executed as a result of that piece of work?
That's right. No animals were harmed, I can assure you.
And from that role, you then shifted across, as you said, to the brave new world of NBN. The first 6 years there saw you really responsible for the business-to-business interfaces. So, again, not dissimilar to, I guess, some of the pressure you would have felt on the Telstra transformation project as well, and really allowing NBN to connect to its customers. It's a pretty important role that you landed in, covering representation to stakeholders, government, NBN execs, RSP, telco users all across Australia. We're all dependent on those interfaces that you were building.
Yeah, I'd been angling for the role, frankly, for the NBN since I'd returned from the UK. I guess I saw it as a logical extension to the work that I did with Openreach, which I guess in part also involved their customer-facing B2B platform. You know, interestingly, I first applied at the NBN for a solution architect role, but I was guided by the good folk at NBN to take on that industry integration manager position. But it's really funny how serendipity works, because it turns out it was an opportunity to put my years of experience in sort of network OSS, BSS, even operations and regulatory into good effect. Because when I joined the NBN, it was early days. We just finished mapping out the BSS OSS solution, which I guess actually itself was a unique opportunity to do that in a fully greenfield situation. Mm-hmm. We very rarely get that opportunity. But anyway, in my role, I was responsible for working with all of our retail service providers to define, I guess, build and onboard them to NBN's B2B. There's lots of elements in terms of how I would term success, but I think defining the interface and the process is really only part of the problem. It's as much about providing, I think, a collaborative environment that ensures, you know, RSPs fully understand how they are going to best leverage those processes to advocate and deliver on a great customer experience. Because you've got to think about it, the NBN effectively was underpinning the entire fixed line telecommunication network here in Australia. So there's a significant opportunity to positively improve the experience of RSPs and end customers. But you know what, to some extent, there's also a risk that if you get it wrong, you can end up with more than just angry customers. So taking that sort of collaborative approach rather than maybe a traditional approach of here's the interface, it's our way or the highway, was a mindset that I took into the NBN. But I also need to be fair, that B2B interface was very much driven collaboratively through the Communications Alliance. Mm-hmm. And that was a great approach, because it was a way to gain consensus, thrash it out, where it's not seen as NBN taking a particular position, but genuinely trying to listen to what our customers need and develop that interface in the best interest. And I think the other thing that I'd reflect on is that we're not silos, that the work that the Comms Alliance used was very much based on that work that OpenReach did that was contributed into the standards body. So I think in recognition, the fact that, you know, we basically built on the top of the foundation of others, I felt it was really important to take that collaborative approach. And then ultimately, as we can touch on later on, is that what I was able to achieve at NBN was to contribute back into the telemanagement forum our APIs and the common information model that in effect kickstarted the TMF Open API work that was done.
I guess it was also really important, the Comms Alliance, because it really gave voice to some of the little guys too. It wasn't just you were designing those interfaces for the behemoth telcos here in Australia, but also all of the little service providers.
Yeah, look, it's a good point. And I think the thing that we all need to be mindful of is that an API that sits on the shelf is useless. So you've got to understand adoption and what drives adoption. And you have to have an understanding of what the operational, I guess the commercial environment is that all of your players are operating in. You've got to be mindful that you lower the barrier to implement. And that means at the time at the NBN, we basically ended up with a range of different technologies. You know, we had the traditional portal, which is, you know, for those that don't want to invest in business-to-business integration can still have an equivalent capability on the portal, albeit the swiveling into it. We went down the path of a so-called EBXML technology for NBN initially. And by the way, we took that approach not only because it was the same approach taken at OpenReach, but it provides out of the box for, you know, security and what we call non-repudiation, you know, but basically the building blocks in terms of connectivity between the gateways just comes out of the box. But it's also awfully expensive and very constrained in implementation. And down the track, NBN then also implemented REST-based APIs as an alternative, and those were better suited to more traditional web development methodologies. And that and those sets of APIs were what spawned the TMF APIs.
And would have been a much greater uptake, as you said, because it was in the hands of more of the web developers and so forth. It was actually in your next role, again at NBN, where we finally did cross paths officially. And it was a case, I guess, of out of the frying pan and into the fire when you went from industry integrations to network assurance. And without those systems, NBN would have been unable to handle incidents, change, customer notification. It wasn't just a case of keeping the lights on for those mission-critical systems, but there was significant transformation underway for you and the team to manage those too, wasn't there?
Yeah, I guess there was. And look, when I think about the sort of, when I say, you know, the IT sort of journey within NBN, it's probably useful just to sort of break it down. I guess there were sort of three phases. Phase one was all about building out the network. It was really focused on the network design and build. We only had a small footprint of the network. So in those early days, we could get by with a pretty limited BSS sort of OSS solution that was more focused on front-end sort of customer order management and billing and also being able to activate and assure the network, but plenty of swivel chairs in that. Then we moved on to a faster cadence of product launches, and those were heady days, you know, when in rapid succession we did the fiber, you know, we launched a couple of satellites, we had HFC, FTTN, and all of that necessarily required stand-up of, you know, additional applications. We needed to get rid of those manual swivels in order to be able to scale. And that lent us more towards, I guess, the more traditional outsourcing type approach. We had a number of big partners. We played the role of a prime SI, but we had a number of big players there helping and supporting stand that up. And then after we sort of did those product launches, we transitioned into what I would think of as a more traditional sort of delivery cadence where we've got fewer big major releases, but we need to be more nimble, more efficient in the way that we do those deployments. And so I guess the transformation that you're referring to relates to our move from that sort of larger scale systems integrated pattern to a scaled agile approach. And when I joined that network assurance team, you'll remember we had one of the largest delivery outfits in the NBN with around about 150 devs, leads, solution designers, operational support. But I'd have to say that sort of journey to scaled agile took us a good 12 months, and there were so many twists and turns along the way. Some of the challenges that we faced included that quite significant cultural mindset that needs to be in place. a move away from that sort of command and control, more towards servant leadership style, but also, you know, the buy-in from our business exec to commit not insignificant resources to be able to support that sort of really close collaboration that Scaled Agile really requires.
I really felt like the first few releases, probably the cadence actually slipped in terms of productivity as people got to understand Agile. But then once Agile really took off and people got used to it, the next PIs were getting better and better. And within the first few quarters, things were probably to a faster cadence, better cadence than they were beforehand. But what were your recollections of what worked and what didn't through that transition to Agile?
Yeah, look, it's very true. It's a it's quite a shift in the mindset, and very definitely, you know, there's pitfalls. And I think the real challenge that we had is that there was plenty of unknowns. We hadn't been through that journey before. And so one of the things that I think really helped us along that journey was that we partnered with some fantastic mentors and coaches, people in the industry that had done this type of journey before, that could really shine a light on where the problems were. When I think about some of the key success factors, I guess it's really important that you have buy-in, that you take people on the journey. You can very clearly articulate the vision. So here we are today. Where do we want to get to? Why are we undertaking this journey? And for people, it's really important that they understand what does it mean for them. Otherwise, it's like any big change program, you're going to face resistance. But I think one of the other key things is, I mentioned that it's really important that you get the buy-in from the execs, because they have to commit not only, you know, additional resources. So in Scaled Agile, we call those the product owners. They're the business representatives that have effectively got to co-locate and sidle up with the delivery teams that do everything from, you know, helping define requirements to validating assumptions to working on the, you know, the breakdown of those requirements into, you know, small packages of work, getting involved in acceptance testing. It's a huge commitment, but it is fundamental to getting Scaled Agile right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really feel like big OSS projects, it's all about momentum of the project. The breakdown of work is so important. It probably required a slightly different mindset to the breakdown of work, but if you get that right, you can really demonstrate a lot of more progress in small steps than you can with a big bang OSS BSS launch.
Yeah, of course. And if I'm honest as well, I'd sort of say that getting that mindset, getting that culture right is vital, but you've got to be realistic. Not everyone is going to be on board. And certainly in my experience, not everyone was on board. So whilst you want to help every individual with that transition, it's also important that you are realistic. And if you've got people that are not on board and not supportive, you've got to be prepared to make some hard decisions, because otherwise, that can really impact culture and the progress within the team. So it was certainly some of the challenges that we had with that team of 150 getting us across the line in that journey.
Yeah, it was a fascinating time. And after that 8-plus-year stint at NBN, then you moved on to Vocus. Are you able to tell us a little bit about Vocus's size, scope, products?
Yeah, for sure. Well, look, Vocus is a what we call a challenger. We like to call ourselves a challenger telco, the leading sort of specialist in the fibre network solutions provider space. We own and operate a significant fibre network, about 30,000 kilometres of fibre. It's all purpose built, and it includes about 15,000 kilometres of terrestrial fibre that connects all of our capital and regional centres. We've got coastal and inland routes as well that support low latency and redundancy. We've also got what we call an ASC, Australian Singapore cable. It's a 60 terabyte cable that's about 5,000 kilometres. We've also got a northwest cable system that connects the Australian continent with some of our offshore oil and gas facilities between Darwin and Port Hedland. And also Vocus has got a 6,000-kilometre regional backbone FlexBots program, which is operated by us on behalf of the Commonwealth Government. So we've got a fantastic fibre asset. In terms of our sort of product offerings, they're pretty broad. They span everything from networks and connectivity, and that's your traditional Ethernet, IP WAN, internet transit, dark fibre type products. We also look after workplace collaboration. That's your telephony, SIP, Zoom collaboration. And also, if I'm honest, we've got some dusty products in there on PSDN and ISDN as well, but also platforms and security. And that includes infrastructure as a service, Google Cloud, managed services, data center locations, etc. The area of focus that I'm involved in really focuses on enterprise, government and wholesale, although the Vocus Group itself also has a few retail service providers that folks would know, and that's Doho and Primus.
Yeah, absolutely. Some really interesting brands in there, as well as a really important infrastructure footprint to support diversity in Australian telco. And in your 18 months there so far as principal IT architect, you've already tackled some of the really important transformation part of the journey that we alluded to in the intro. But before we dive too deep on that, are you able to describe a little bit about your remit?
Yeah, sure. So, here at Vocus, I'm an end-to-end solution architect for our Future State program. And that effectively, the Future State program squarely targeted leveraging this fibre network together with some next-generation network capabilities to be able to blend that with sort of cloud and our infrastructure managed service offerings to, I guess, bring to light our intent to be a real challenger in the market. But in terms of my role, it's very broad. It spans largely the BSS and OSS with a little bit of a sort of tentacles down into the network. But it's really focused on ensuring that we and our partners have a well-defined solution across all of our business domains, applications and technologies. But of course, it's not me alone. I'm well supported by a talented group of enterprise architects, and those guys map out strategies, principles, some of the things I'm sure we'll talk about today, and also our in-state architecture, and also a group of, domain-level subject matter experts. But basically I look after the overall BSS, OSS, and, making sure that we don't have too many gotchas when it comes to that user acceptance testing.
Easier said than done, though.
Indeed.
Yeah, so does it also cover into a push into data science, process re-engineering, things like that as well?
Probably data science, yes, to the extent that we are moving towards, we're not there yet, but we're moving towards what some folks would call closed loop automation, what we called at the NBN cognitive operations. And it's effectively saying, hey, we want to leverage machine learning, slash AI to do some pretty smart and clever things. Well, in order to get there, for example, requires, a well-constructed information model and what I would call data complete inventory. So we can see that closed loop automation on our horizon. What we're focused on in the near term is making sure that we've got the solution, the data models, and if you like, the catalog and validation rules around it to make sure we are data complete when we launch these products.
Yeah, absolutely. Great touch point too on the cognitive assurance and the fact that the data and all the building blocks have to be in place. You can't just put this miracle system on top that solves all those problems if there's data integrity type issues.
Indeed.
Are you able to describe for us why this transformation is so important to the future of Vocus and perhaps a little bit about the legacy that you're looking to overcome as well?
Yeah. Well, Vocus has had many acquisitions over the past couple of years, and that's really challenged us in terms of our ability to scale. And would you believe that we've needed, through those acquisitions, to maintain no less than 6 legacy networks and at least that many legacy BSS stacks? So that's quite a challenge for us. So we started this transformation journey back in 2019. And it's probably fair to say that whilst, that catalyst was to say we've got this fantastic network in terms of an asset, but we want to introduce a so-called software-defined network or programmable network. And in order to do that, we needed to really sit down and address the problems that stem from those acquisitions. And those challenges, those problems were not only pain points for us, but also importantly for our customers as well. So when we think about this transformation journey, it's probably worth just reflecting on what some of those pain points really, you know, really were. And I'll just throw a couple of things out there, and I'm sure some of this is going to resonate with some of your listeners, but we had this huge inflexible product catalogue. Every combination of price points reflected as an entry in our catalogue, and I kid you not, we had over 60,000 SKUs or individual, you know, orderable products within our catalogue. Can you imagine what that challenge is for both our customers and our sales team to find the right product? And invariably, if they couldn't find the right product, they'd throw their hands up and just create a new one. It just exacerbates the problem. With no catalogue integration, the process to define any new offering is manual. And of course, you can see the issues that throws up in terms of inventory management and the like. And, you know, another aspect that each of our products, each of these SKUs is defined as a single specification, big flat specification. So there's no concept of reusing common network assets or reusing fiber or that sort of stuff. And our quotes process similarly was largely manual, what we call price on application. So customers could go to a portal, request a quote, but it effectively fell out to our sales team to have to manage and I guess do that heavy lifting. And the fact that we had, you know, these IT silos meant that there was no single view of information, be that across our customer view, be that across our network view. There was no sort of complete accurate inventory. And also just in terms of our customer portals, very disjointed experience, depending on the segment, the type of customer that you were or the type of product that you were interested in. You could have to jump around a range of different portals with a range of different integrations and experiences. So look, that's where we were, but it also gave us clear line of sight to the sort of outcomes that we needed to achieve through this transformation.
A really common experience that you explained there. I think a lot of the listeners would relate to that too. And being a challenger means that you have to be really nimble with your business model.
Yeah.
You can't be nimble with the business model if you've got so many moving parts, the OSS, BSS, and 60,000 SKUs means it's almost like every service for every customer is bespoke. And
exactly.
The ramifications of that for support, for testing, for the OSS build, and everything else falls out of that. And so you've been responsible for a number of OSS and BSS builds and transformations over the last couple of decades. But I get the impression that there were some really important differences with this one, such as using an open rather than proprietary API stack. What were the similarities and differences with this focus transformation?
Yeah, it's true that I think as an industry, just in recent times, we've seen some really significant movement in the development and I guess the uptake of those open APIs. And I think there's probably been a number of drivers as to why that's been the case. There's been a real focus on value chain. So that is that we're recognising that the customer experience really requires that all suppliers are pulling in the same direction. Also a focus on data. You know, this notion of transparency, timely communications, meeting your commitments, all of these things require complete and joined up information right across the enterprise. But I think also more broadly, in my mind, what really moves the needle here at Focus is the realization of what we call a dynamic architecture. You see, in responding to some of these challenges and constraints, you know, in our legacy systems, you know, we're about making things better, simpler, easier. And, you know, we have a bit of a catch cry here at Focus, and it's called Brilliant Made Simple. And that dynamic architecture really does underpin this goal. And I'm happy to unpick that a bit more, but what stands under that dynamic architecture, it's realised by a range of things, but certainly those open APIs are an important part of the picture. And I think the important thing is that at this point in time, there is now good maturity in the API definitions, the associated processes, definitions in the information models, but also importantly, our vendors and partners have a real and tangible capability today on the applications and pretty strong roadmaps that make realising these visions just that much simpler.
Yeah, really good point too. So you talk a little bit about those partners. Were they really, because they do these projects on a regular basis, were they the ones kind of helping you to champion some of those modern practices, or was that really your internal team guiding that and then delegating to the likes of Sienna and Digit to then go and implement to those standards?
Yeah, great question. Look, it's probably a combination of my enterprise architecture colleagues, because really, you know, they set the direction here at Focus, and they'd set that direction before I landed. But it is also a collaboration with our partners. And in our case, it's Digit, which is a local group here in Melbourne, and Sienna Blue Planet. But I also want to recognise, I think, the valuable work that both the MEF and the TMF have done in their respective open architectures. In the TMF, we used to talk about process frameworks and standard applications and, you know, rigid information models. But the TMF Open Digital Architecture, for example, it's all about catalog-driven products and services underpinned by a common information model. And that really allows for discovery, exchange of offerings at runtime that are well specified, that allow our providers and consumers to really rapidly deploy new products. So, look, it was a combination of that sort of clear technology architecture, a roadmap to get there, and the capabilities that are with our partners. But I also think one of the things, at least from a technology standpoint, that was front of mind when we looked to partner with Sienna and Digit, is that I've got to tell you, there's an air gap that exists between a paper specification and building and deploying a capability in production. And both Sienna and Digit, these open APIs and the principles that underpin this dynamic architecture really are in their DNA. They're not only thought leaders in the standards, setting the paper-based standards, if you will, but they're also involved in what the Telemanagement Forum call catalysts. And these catalysts are almost like incubators, if you like, and they work on real-world problems. Often those problems come to the catalyst through service providers like BT and Telefonica and Orange, AT&T, even Vocus. But around that problem, they'll effectively realise a proof of concept. So you've actually got an implementation that spans these applications. Now, in the case of Sienna and Blue Planet, they had demonstrated that they could solve a range of problems, you know, across fulfillment and billing, as well as assurance, that gave us confidence that, you know, there was a genuine out-of-the-box capability, because clearly, like most customers, you want to minimise the tech debt or bespoke development that you have to build.
Yeah, really good point. And the fact that Blue Planet and Digit had worked together on some past implementations, whether it's the catalyst that you mentioned and maybe another customer or two, that perhaps you even got a few free kicks, a little bit of a reduction in the integration tax because they'd already built some of the integration between each other.
Oh, absolutely. And that is certainly the case. But I think also we should underscore it's more than just an API. And it's probably worth us touching on and expanding on a little bit about, you know, what is meant by this dynamic architecture. But I'd just say that the APIs need to be supported by a common information model. And, these partners not only support those APIs, but also have common language in terms of how to implement those catalog models. And certainly is the case with a global player like Sienna, where they've implemented this, you know, these sort of complex enterprise level, you know, network products with other carriers. You get the benefit of some of these out-of-the-box solutions. So Sienna has got this notion of, you know, vertically integrated solutions that can take a particular network vendor, in our case it's Arista, together with a set of sort of standard service models that are perhaps vendor agnostic, and they can translate those out of the box. They can translate those service constructs into the network activation configuration required on a per vendor basis. So that's a huge advantage.
I found it really interesting that you really picked and chose between which of TM Forum, which of the MEF LSO data patterns to use. Was that blending of standards a really tricky decision? And do you expect that there will be ongoing ramifications like tech debt or benefits perhaps coming from the way that you chose what you did?
Yeah, good question. Actually, well, I don't really see it as an us versus them type thing. Both the MEF and the TMF have our respective strengths. Here at Focus, we use the TMF for the APIs themselves. Think of that as the sort of header and framework, if you like, for the APIs. And we certainly use the telemanagement forum information model as the basis of our enterprise level payloads. But when it comes to modeling service and network constructs, we use MEF. We use MEF to drive what we call the customer facing resources and the resource facing services and all of the attributes that stand alongside that. And think about our external APIs, our suppliers, and potentially even our wholesale customers. They're all interested in our network product offerings, and they all expect MEF-aligned data models to support not only those operational interfaces, but also their inventory. So I guess this blending is sort of a natural fit. And just to underscore it, where MEF is strong is obviously in the sort of service and network constructs, and we're able to leverage this dynamic architecture, this payload-driven approach to drive particularly the sort of service activation, service inventory, service order management type APIs with a MEF-type payload.
And often when we talk about those APIs, we're talking about it for only exposure to internal teams, like maybe it's the portal developers or the northbound systems to interact with. But I really feel like some of the potential around that is exposure externally. So opening up that potential for a long tail of innovation for other developers to come in and take some of your product offerings and blend it with some others, is that something that's part of your thinking as well? And do you see some potential in that?
Yeah, I think there's probably two ways that I'd tackle that question. Specific to Focus and what we're doing in Future State, absolutely. So this, you know, central to this notion of both self-serving, allowing our customers to self-serve, but in ways that make sense to them. The technology stack, if you want to think of it, is broken down in terms of design time and runtime. So at design time, we define our product offerings. And at Focus, we have a very tightly bound set of what I would call commodity customer-facing services. They are reusable service components that are well-defined, but when we go up towards the product constructs and the product offerings, we can blend those in a multitude of different ways, and we don't want to overly constrain the way that we do those offerings. Now, that catalogue is defined at runtime, the way in which we build our products, and all of the validation rules and all of that sort of stuff is codified within the catalogue. That catalogue is discoverable. At runtime, we need our consumers to be able to query the catalogue, understand the offerings that are right for them, and then be able to order price ashore, for example, at runtime. So coming back to that, our portal, for example, as I think you mentioned, rightly consumes that catalogue, so it can discover those set of offerings and consumes the product order management and inventory, for example, and price books and quoting APIs and all of that sort of good stuff, that we can render a particular journey that is based on the type of customer that that we're interacting with, effectively what we call a persona. So we can build flexible journeys based on the underlying APIs that we've exposed. But similarly for B2B, we want to do exactly the same thing. We want to be able to support our customers discovering our catalogue, to be able to do intent-based queries to sort of say, well, okay, I'm really interested in a data connectivity product with these type of characteristics. What have you got on offer? Okay, we've got, you know, an IP WAN offering or an SD-WAN offering or an Ethernet offering, and then understanding where the customer wants to deliver those endpoints of the services and understanding the capabilities that are exposed at that particular site, we can then further qualify the applicability of that offering to the customer. So all of that flexibility and richness we want to provide. But what I've been talking about is really geared towards Focus's customer, and that customer's obviously a customer that's interested primarily in a complex enterprise-level network or managed service. when I step out of my thinking about Vocus and reflect more broadly at the opportunities that I think these APIs and this dynamic architecture provides, more and more when we think about our digitally connected world where we want to be able to support innovation, where perhaps a telecommunications service, either, you know, infrastructure or cloud-based, is only a part of that overall digital service offering, then these APIs, the ability of having a catalogue that's discoverable, a price book that's discoverable, and exposing this as a set of very fine-grained technologies that can be rapidly built together in innovative ways by consumers that are not necessarily telecommunication service providers, I think is something that is on the horizon for us. And when you think about it purely from a service provider standpoint, where some would think of us as just a utility, then so-called bums on seats or getting services in operation, being able to make that network capability, that asset, if you will, available to non-traditional players, super important.
Yeah, absolutely. It really excites me. I guess it's we've gone through that phase where a new business model of the MVNOs arose maybe a few decades ago, but now that potential to do the digital virtual operators that use the platforms of other network providers and create really innovative service offerings or bundles.
Yeah. And Ryan, I think just in closing off on that sort of thought as well, is that it's not just about APIs. I come back to the really smart, intelligent capabilities that we've got in our modern networks these days. So traditionally, yeah, this notion of, well, I'm buying a particular service and I'm buying it at this particular speed and I'm going to get charged on a monthly basis at that speed. And boy, oh boy, the commercial constructs are if I flex my speed up or down, there's invariably commercial hoops that I've got to jump through. Mm-hmm. We see the industry moving more and more away from a usage-based approach. And when I think about the flexibility that's available on these software-defined networks, you want to be able to allow customers to be able to go in and, you know, flex bandwidth in very small increments, almost, you know, like a little dial for, you know, variable periods of time that best suit them. So, for example, we can envisage a circumstance where a customer's got a data connectivity between a corporate site and a data center. And during the day, they want to dial that capability up to bias towards their corporate traffic, perhaps their internet traffic. But at night when they're doing site backups and this sort of stuff, you want to be able to dial the service more towards that nature. And that has implications in terms of the way in which you're prioritizing and managing traffic for that customer across the network. That level of flexibility, supported by those innovative product offerings through a simple, intuitive, easy to use interface with simple commercial constructs that are easy to understand, I think you start to get a sense of where the vision is within our industry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really exciting stuff. And I really love the concept, too, of it all being catalog-driven. So with the CFS, RFS, orchestration plans around that, one of my concerns, though, is that the SKU counts, the product offerings, have that potential to proliferate if the product teams get overzealous again. Have you needed to do anything to mitigate that, or is the fact that that northbound interface says here's a more restricted offering and you do the bundling more with that PSR, CFS type?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, one of, you know, standardizations, you could almost look at it as a double-edged sword. You know, the benefits of standardization is commonality, but you've got to be really mindful that you've got to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. You know, you don't want to be going out with the same sort of products and constructs. So how do you achieve that? And the last thing that we want to do is put too many guardrails on our ability to innovate in the market. Having said that, we don't want to go back to those bad old days of large SKU counts and unstructured orders and incomplete inventory and this sort of stuff. So I have touched on it, but the way that we achieve it, as you rightly call out, is through that product service resource model. And that effectively means that you can't do anything within our BSS stack that isn't defined in the catalog. So what we want to be able to do is introduce an ability to rapidly build those market-facing offerings and launch them in the marketplace. And we do that through a combination of having a tightly bound or constrained set of service components, what we call the customer-facing services, and a simple ability for our products people to be able to coordinate those or build those into very flexible offerings. And it's not just the catalog, but it's also the price books that go alongside that. So, and I think the other key thing is to have that sort of single catalog that can be rapidly distributed around the applications that need it. So what, you know, very simply put, if we have a new network capability, we could rapidly integrate that network capability into our service catalog that's exposed through Sienna Blue Planet, now OSS. That's immediately visible and available to our product catalog at design time. So we can now go and rapidly form up that market offering in the pricing constructs. Once that is effectively deployed into our production environment, it's automatically synchronized across our configure price quote solution, our product order management orchestration layer, and of course our billing platform. So right there, it's available for our customer facing portals to be ordered. We've got very flexible dynamic pricing and quoting mechanisms that are around that. So it can be priced up and then of course flow through to orchestration for fulfillment, and then through onto billing. So a long-winded way of saying that we welcome and encourage the flexibility to innovate in the market, but through this dynamic architecture, we're able to make sure that we maintain integrity both across our BSS and OSS. So that's the vision.
And when you talk about flexible pricing, are we talking flex and surge type pricing, or is it more flexible on a week-by-week, month-by-month type basis?
It's probably both. Actually, when I was thinking about flexible pricing, when I think about those SKUs, the reason we had so many of them is that every permutation and combination of orderable information that could impact the price had a separate SKU. So when I think about that flexible pricing, one element of that is what we call the dynamic pricing. In our catalog, we might have an Ethernet product, for example, and that Ethernet product, the price, the standard price book can be driven by parameters like, you know, the obvious things like speed, the type of access technology that we're building out, the assurance level that you want, contract term, for example, it might be the number of licenses, all that sort of standard stuff that you can bring together in a runtime approach to arrive at a particular price. Of course, we've got the ability for our salespeople to negotiate that price with customers. But yes, then beyond that, our standard constructs, and this particularly relates to some of our aggregated sort of transit products, we have the ability to have what you call sort of surge pricing or aggregate pricing that's based on usage across multiple trunks, that sort of stuff. Yeah, all of that sort of stuff is supported.
Fantastic. I know from working with you that you're really adept at making transformations about the business outcomes rather than just playing out some sort of personal tech fantasy. The numbers appear to be quite strong on the transformation you've undertaken, just on the back of things like the 60,000 SKUs and the 8 BSSs that you're consolidating and things like that. Do you have any suggestions for the listeners about how to make digital transformation business cases more compelling? Maybe not just this one, but other past successes as well.
It stands to reason that any business case has got to clearly define the metrics. And where we can tend to get a bit wishy-washies in terms of those indirect benefits. So I guess in my experience, it's really important that you root that transformation to, you know, to tangible benefits. And for us, it essentially relates to either cost out. So, you know, we're being specific about, you know, the benefits in reducing manual handling, perhaps reducing fallout, increasing, you know, customer self-service, a set of metrics or benefits around customer experience. So for us, the concrete stuff that we measure around that, sort of increasing right first time, perhaps decreasing connection or restoration service levels, increased NPS, things that are tangible and measurable. But then also There's the ability to scale or grow your market share. And obviously, you know, those things need to be tied back to hard revenue targets. And in our case, those revenue targets are typically linked back to particular, you know, market or product segments as well.
Mm. Similar to that, so we talked a little bit earlier about the common data model being really important and heavily investing in that to get it right. Well, and also the consolidation. Are you seeing the fruits of those labors in terms of data insight generation, or is that going to be more like next phase? Because I know you're still in the middle of this transformation and what it's going to deliver.
I think truth be told, early days around the insights, but let me just step back a bit. And you remember at the start of our conversation, I was calling out some of the pain points, the fact that we've got these silos, the fact that we've got incomplete data, and that causes problems for all of the obvious reasons. So our first motivation was to make sure that we had no air gaps in our inventory and we were data complete. What do we mean by that? Air gaps are where at design time, you haven't joined information that you later understand is necessary. It relates to the schemas that are incomplete. The data quality issues, being data complete, means, yeah, okay, your schema allows for it, but for whatever reason, you haven't got mandatory validation rules, whatever it might be, you don't have a complete picture of that particular inventory. We needed to tackle that in the first instance. And the way that we went about that is that we undertook and defined an enterprise information model. That's effective, if you want to think of it, it's effectively the enterprise logical model that would sit, for want of a better word, in your enterprise data warehouse. But that effectively defines all of the key information that we need, the characteristics around that information, and obviously the relationships across that. And when we built that EIM, we built it through the perspective of the processes. So we looked at our 2B processes, you know, informed by those metrics that, you know, that we wanted to achieve, and made sure that each step of that process was supported by the right information. And when it came to building out that EIM, we were, you know, we took some guidance from the telemanagement forum SID, but not religious guidance, because it's massive. Again, we focused on what was relevant to Vocus, informed by those particular processes. And that in turn helped us define not only the common information models for the new applications that we were standing up in future state, but also really importantly informed the migration activities that we had to undertake from our legacy platforms to our 2B platform. So right now we are confident that we've got a data model that supports all of the sort of enterprise reporting, performance reporting, and also is data complete to be able to support not only, you know, standard handoff from fulfillment to assurance, but also, as I mentioned a bit earlier, our aspiration heading towards that sort of closed loop automation. But to getting back to your point around customer insights, etc., we are well positioned. Here at Vocus, we use Salesforce as our CRM, and there is a very strong linkage between, if you like, the on-platform data models within Salesforce that relate to, you know, the sales forecasting and opportunities and revenues, etc., that's going to give us those insights. But also importantly, when we think about the assurance side and case management, all of that sort of stuff is joined up. So we can see not only what the intent is for our customers and what that might mean in terms of future sales opportunities, but also we can get insights into how we're performing for our customers in terms of being able to serve their needs. So I would say we've got the foundations in place and we're working towards leveraging some of the benefits around those insights.
Fantastic. And earlier on we touched about that this whole podcast was probably spawned by the video that you put out on YouTube from the TM Forum event. And I've got to thank you for sharing that too, because it provides some brilliant insights. And I'll put that in the show notes for people to go and watch. Without spoiling some of the punchlines from that, there were some follow-up questions at the end asked by the audience, and again, the great call-outs that you made there. You're able to share with people who are about to embark on a similar journey of transformation, things to look out for, guiding hints and tips?
Yeah, well, look, transformation is a good word, isn't it? You could probably drive a truck through it. I think you've got to have clear line of sight to your vision and the metrics that matter. And for us, there are a few things, and they relate to that sort of mantra of brilliant simplicity. We were very customer focused. Everything that we did was informed by customer journeys. And so I think having that clear, if you like, laser focus on the couple of metrics that matter, holding yourself to account both when you're doing the design and as you deploy and measure, those benefits, obviously super important. But I also think beyond the sort of business perspective of that transformation, it's really important if you're going to partner to really test the credentials and capabilities of your partners. I would share two observations. One, that there's obviously a benefit with going with a large global player. And that benefit is essentially you get the benefit of a rich product roadmap that's informed by, the work that they're doing with similar related customers. But there's a flip side of that too. And certainly for Vocus, where we're not, a large player, that you are but one voice in trying to steer that ship. And so establishing those good relationships with your vendors and your product team is important. But I reflect on some of the advantage with going with some of the more nimble players, and Digit's an example of that, where we're able to partner with them in very useful and meaningful ways. So they share our vision, and we're able to sort of help really steer their roadmap, and that benefits us, obviously.
Yeah, really important call-outs too, because you're getting the benefit of having a group of people who've experienced multiple times before, whereas you and your organization may only do one transformation. They're doing multiple as they go from customer to customer, and there's that aggregate of learning. But also in the video, you touched on the importance of you may delegate and you may bring on that experience from externals, but you still retain accountability for everything that happens, and making sure that you're not delegating all responsibility as well.
Oh, so true. And I'm sure we can all reflect on various times in our career where we may have outsourced sort of too much, and with the aspiration that, sure, these partners will play nice together. No, look, at the end of the day, as a solution architect, you've got to recognise that the accountability sits within our organisation, our role, again, being to define that sort of coherent end-to-end solution and capabilities, but you've got to retain ownership of that. And that's certainly the case. So we certainly partner. We welcome insights from our partners, and in fact expect our partners to be able to some extent, be thought leaders and help guide us. But at the end of the day, we've got to eat our own dog food, don't we? And the buck stops with us. So yes, we certainly retain overall accountability for our solution.
Mm. All right. So getting really close to the end of the podcast now. What do you feel like the future holds for OSS Telco, especially for telcos like Vocus, the challenger telcos, and how are you positioning for it?
Yeah, well, I think as I sort of touched on earlier, that ability to self-serve, support very flexible interactions with all types of customers in ways and mechanisms that make sense to them, I think is going to be a continuing trend. I also think that more broadly, again, if I step outside of Vocus and think more broadly for our industry, it's about enabling that sort of, if you like, that sort of digital economy. And I think key elements of that, I've touched on sort of fine-grained open APIs with low barriers of adoption, meaning, you don't necessarily have to be a carriage service provider, but also working with innovators in this space to really adopt those capabilities, digital ecosystems, digital marketplaces, less around point-to-point sort of integrations on B2B and more about point-to-multi-point, super important. And so therefore, I think there's going to be a continuing focus on standardization. And I think for those that are going to listen to the forum that I was involved in, one of the other call-outs that I made was that I'd like to see a greater harmonisation, standardisation between TMF and MEF. They've started, that there's a way to go. But I also think that catalog-driven approach, the discoverability of offerings and network services and even things like field services that could be made available and blended in innovative ways by folks that see, you know, network services as just a component of a digital offering, I think is an important part of our future.
Brilliant. So really appreciated the chat today, Martin. I found some fascinating insights. And again, thanks again for sharing today, but also in that video. If people wanted to continue the conversation, where can they find you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, so feel free to look me up and reach out. Very happy to connect.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you once again, and thanks also for the audience for listening in to today's episode. And we look forward to getting another episode out to you shortly.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the Passionate About OSS podcast. You can find more episodes, more than 2,500 blogs, and our contact details over at passionateaboutoss.com.